Okay, guys, so the first learning opportunity that we're doing this morning is a very special individual, Rabbi Mitzvah Kreidowitz, who God willing will have the opportunity to hear from him several times, possibly, you know, more as often as we can possibly get Rabbi Kreidowitz to join us. It is a tremendous privilege to have him, you know, speak with us. So you definitely have the opportunity. Definitely, for sure, 100% take notes. Every word is a gem. And just to tell you a little bit about Rabbi Kreidowitz, who he is. So Rabbi Kreidowitz received his rabbinical ordination in the very famous Neri Yisrael Yeshiva. Anyone from Baltimore, Maryland, over here? All right. So anyone who's heard of Baltimore, Maryland, so Rabbi Kreidowitz has got it. It's a very, very, very special Yeshiva in Neri Yisrael. That's where Rabbi Kreidowitz studied for many years and became got his ordination. While also, he also received a different type of degree, the degree from Harvard Law School, and went on to continue being a professor of law at University of Maryland. And all that sounds great, but if you were to ask Rabbi Kreidowitz himself, I'd say the greatest thing is losing that you get from studying Torah, which you guys are going to see over the next couple weeks. And it's a tremendous privilege to have him here at Orsamath with us, and a wealth of knowledge, like anything under the sun, any questions about, he is the go-to person on that. So without further ado, I don't want to take even a second away from him, Rabbi Kreidowitz.
Thanks, Rabbi Kreidowitz. First of all, hi everybody, I want to welcome you to Eretz Yisrael. As I hope you all know, this is your home, this is the home of the Jewish people, and we hope that you'll feel very, very connected, because this indeed is the place. Robert Frost used to say, home is the one place where they can't tell you to get out, and there's something like that, I'm paraphrasing, I think, and indeed, the very first law of the state of Israel, the secular state of Israel, was the law of return, that every Jew that comes to Israel is guaranteed citizenship, and certainly that's the spiritual idea as well. And we hope, too, that you're going to take advantage of your time here to reconnect to your Judaism, discover what it is, and become an ambassador to bring holiness and sanctity and connection to your friends who did not have the privilege of being here for this session. And again, it's a big tribute to you that I'm sure there's a lot of stuff you can do in the summer and there's a lot of places you could go. And the fact that you've opted to come here to study Torah and learn about your connection and your identity and your history is really a tribute to the fact that, as we say, every Jew has a spark of holiness within them that does want to connect. So, as I say, you are very much an inspiration to us, and we, all of our teachers here, we learn as much, if not more, from you than you may learn from us. So we're very, very grateful, very happy that you are here. The topic today, again, I sometimes veer from the topic. I don't find myself obligated, but the topic today, I think, was relationships, and that's a very important point to talk about, really, for two reasons. Reason number one is that people sometimes have an artificial conception of what the religious life is. They think religious life, you know, you gotta keep kosher, you gotta keep Shabbos, you can't do this, can't do that. And of course it is true that God has given us a lot of restrictions. We're not animals, we don't just do whatever it is we want. But people sometimes think that things like interpersonal ethics, whether it's honesty in business, whether it's how you treat your spouse, how you treat your kids, they think, well, that's not religious. That's general morality or general social mores. But that's not really true. The same Torah that says a Jew is supposed to keep the Shabbat and keep kosher and everything else, that Torah also talks about human relationships, how we deal with each other. And when people sometimes say, oh, I read in the newspapers that Orthodox Jews, you know, are not honest in business. Well, my flippant answer somewhat is, well, the same way it would be impossible to say that an Orthodox Jew doesn't keep kosher, because if you don't keep kosher, you're not an Orthodox Jew. I would submit that even if a person keeps the Shabbat and keeps kosher and does everything else, if they are dishonest in business, they cannot really be an Orthodox Jew because they're not following the Torah. The Torah considers human relationships including honesty, integrity, and of course the intimacy between husband and wife and parent and child, to be every bit as important as the ritualistic. Now, I'm not, God forbid, demeaning ritualistic. Rituals themselves are extremely important as well, and hopefully you'll participate and understand that, but it has to be grounded in what are called midot tovot, that means good character attributes. A religious Jew should be a loving person, a kind person, a compassionate person, a giving person. That is part of it. Any type of religious fundamentalism that shuts a person off from the emotion of honest human relationships is a perverted religious feeling in some ways. It is not authentic. Now, do we always live up to those standards? No, we don't. We get angry too. We sometimes say nasty things. But we know that it's wrong. Meaning to say, yeah. No, there's an old saying, somebody said, the biggest mistake in the world is to judge Judaism by the behavior of Jews. And you know, what can I tell you? You know, we are not perfect. When I say we, I just mean, you know, religious Jews. You know, we have failings. But I'm here to describe not necessarily the failings of me as an individual. I'm here to describe, you know, a system of values, a system of ethics, a system of aspirations, so that even if we on occasion mess up, but the system is calling upon us to become better, better people. So one reason why I'm starting with relationships is to kind of bring out at the outset that Judaism is not only about ritual. It is also about human relationships as well. That's a very, very important point. In fact, one of the commentaries makes the point in a very graphic way. You know, Moses comes down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments, right, on the two tablets of stone. And the first tablet, says, if you recall the biblical story, he smashed because of the sin of the golden calf, and then eventually he came down with the second tablets on Yom Kippur, by the way. That's, I don't know if you know this. The reason Yom Kippur is the day of atonement and the day of forgiveness is because that is when God forgave the sin of the golden calf by Moses coming down with the Torah a second time. So, of course, there's a chicken and egg conundrum. Did God forgive us because it was Yom Kippur, or did that become Yom Kippur because God forgave us? Okay, that's an interesting question of what is the cause and what is the effect. But you know, typically there's a very common understanding that we divide the Ten Commandments into two groups. The first five commandments pertain to the duties between man and God. Right, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, so you have to believe in God. Thou shalt not have any other idols. Do not take the name of the Lord in vain. The fourth one is remember the day of Shabbat to keep it holy. Right, those are duties that we owe to the Almighty. Although even there, the fifth one is a little bit of a problem. The fifth one is, what is the fifth commandment? Everyone knows? Yeah. Honor thy father, honor your father and mother. Technically, I would have thought that's interpersonal, but nevertheless, we put it on the God column, because if I am grateful to my parents for giving life, I will love God as well for giving me life. So in effect, it's a transition. Okay, now side two are interpersonal commandments. Don't steal, don't kill, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't give false testimony against your neighbor, and do not covet, do not be jealous of the possessions that someone else has. So in Hebrew, there's a phrase for this. We call the duties owed to God, Bein Adam LaMakom, between man, by man we include women, you know, between the human, and Makom, God. This is a very unusual name for God. Makom technically means the place. One of the rabbinic appellations for the Almighty is He is the place. Strange terminology. But that basically means, because the universe is located within God instead of God being located within the universe. So God is the location within which everything is there. So Bein Adam LaMakom means between man and God. And the second group is called Bein Adam LaChaveiro, between man and his fellow man. So first five, Bein Adam LaMakom. Second five, Bein Adam LaChaveiro. Now, That's observation number one. Observation number two is there are far fewer words in the second five than in the first five. The second five are very staccato. Don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery. Very short. The Ben Adam Makom is longer. For example, Shabbat is a whole long story that God made the world in 6 days, etc. Now, our tradition is that they cover the same amount of surface area. So, imagine you're seeing Moses coming down from Mount Sinai. And you're getting your first glimpse of the Ten Commandments. And you put on your glasses to stare and to see what you're seeing. If you have two columns of engraving, and one column has fewer words, but it takes up the same amount of space, that could only be done if the letter size was bigger. We'd call it the font. The fonts must be bigger. So from a distance, which commandments would you see first? The Ben Adam Lamakom, or the Ben Adam L'Chaveiro? You would actually see the interpersonal commandments first, because they were written in a, or not written, they were engraved in a larger font size. So the lesson here is that the interpersonal might even be more important than the ritualistic. Again, I'm not here to say what's more important. I mean, in a way, everything's important. What's more important, your heart or your brain? You know, you're going to be dead either way without one of them. So in a sense, it's almost fruitless to talk about what's more important. But I do want to bring out at the outset that interpersonal connections is extremely important in Judaism. And this is sometimes a mistake that we make when we define what it is to be a religious person. That's really point number one, why we're talking about relationships. Point number two, that although I'm not specifically talking about sexual relationships, but that's going to come up, is that it is important that we understand the nature of sexual intimacy, the man-woman dynamic. And the reason that's important is that one of the things that undoubtedly you will notice right away is that religious Jews, Jews who follow the Torah, are really very, very strict in terms of what they do with members of the opposite sex. For example, and again, I'm not telling anyone to do anything right now, I'm just giving you information. I'm not here to, you know, we don't brainwash it till at least the second or third day, so, you know, nothing's going to happen today. But as you probably know, or maybe you've observed already, people do not, certainly do not hug or kiss or even hold hands with members of the opposite sex until they are married. There's even laws against being alone in a room because, you know, one could succumb to temptation, right? That I'm not, if I'm talking to a woman that's not my wife, not my child, the door is supposed to be open. By the way, it's very interesting. I want you to know, people look at these laws and they say, oh, they're so old-fashioned, they're so primitive. Are men sex fiends? By the way, if anything, it's not downgrading women, it's downgrading men. You can't put a man alone with a woman because, you know, who knows what's going to happen. People say, that's primitive. But I want you to know that because of the plethora of litigation, let's take the United States, in the area of sexual harassment, which for some reason over the past decade is now pronounced harassment. I don't know why, that's not the pronunciation of the word. I don't know who made that change. It was harassment is the word, but now it's pronounced harassment. A lot of Fortune 500 companies, in their employment manuals, are saying what Judaism has said for 1,000 years. They're saying, hey, when you're talking to a woman, you know, the door should be open, etc. No unrequested touching, etc. So it's very, very interesting that General Motors, Westinghouse, all sorts of Fortune 500 companies are recognizing the need for boundaries. So as a result, people sometimes get the impression that Judaism is prudish, that we consider sex and intimacy to be kind of dirty or embarrassing or the like. So it's important to say at the outset that it's really the opposite. There is a concept in Judaism, there's a concept in our religion that says that the more noble and the more beautiful something is, the more private, the more respect you give it, by keeping it private and by limiting it to relationships of love and not self-gratification. Sexual intimacy within our tradition is a very, very beautiful and holy activity. In fact, it is called a godly activity. That is why celibacy is not considered desirable within the Jewish tradition. Our rabbis and leaders are not supposed to be celibate. The very first commandment in the Torah is to be fruitful and multiply and to try to have children. You know the story about the beleaguered woman. She was going on the bus, the Egged bus, and you have to take an Egged bus, and she brought up 10 children with her, and she was exhausted. She said, I do not know how I will get through the day. And the bus driver said, well, why don't you leave half of your kids at home? And she said, I did. But okay. So there's a great mitzvah to have children, but I want to take this further. The idea of marriage and intimacy is not only as a means to have children, although having children is a great, great blessing. There is an inherent value in expressing love, in intimacy. Even if a marriage is infertile, it's a great, great mitzvah. Now, I'm not going to discuss today if halachically you're allowed to deliberately kind of create an infertile marriage by contraception. That's a separate issue. But it is important to understand that marriage is not only a means of reproduction, propagation of the species. It is inherently a way that we connect to God by learning to love and care about another person. And if indeed we kind of limit our contacts when it's outside of marriage, that is only because sex should never be used as a tool for self-gratification. But it's a use for intimacy, sharing, and the context of a sanctified, holy relationship. The very name for marriage is kiddushin. That is the Hebrew word for marriage. Kiddushin means sacredness, holiness. So if we are on the prudish side, it is not at all because sexual intimacy is dirty, improper, something we're ashamed of. It's the other way around. You know, in the temple, and maybe if you went to around the Temple Mount, the Western Wall, you heard about this. You know, there was part of the temple that was the holiest part of the temple that was called the Holy of Holies. And that was the one part of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, that only one person went in only one time a year on Yom Kippur. The rest of the time, that was where the Ark of the Covenant was. That's where the Ark was. Nobody was allowed to enter, and even the high priest could not enter, except on Yom Kippur. So there is a concept which is very foreign to our publicity-starved world of Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, in which every single thing is a public thing that you announce to the world. There is very much a concept that very important, beloved, sacred ideas, sacred activities, are sometimes meant to be private. And that is not because we're ashamed of them, but it's because they're very, very elevated. Yeah.
Question, you make a distinction between gratification and love and connection.
Yep.
And it seems that there's a notion of something's wrong with, self-gratification.
Okay, so let me talk about that. Let me talk about that a little bit. And that is, let's go back to the original creation. Okay, I'm going to give you a long answer, but hopefully I will address your question directly. Let's go back to the original creation of man and woman. And this goes back to Genesis, right? First there was Adam. And Adam is looking for a partner. And Adam looked at all the animals, and they didn't seem to fit. The cow doesn't really work for me, etc. Okay. And God said to the angels, it is not good for man to be alone. Let us make a partner to be opposite him. Okay? And what happened was, God made Adam fall into a deep sleep, and God separated, actually it doesn't say a rib, but it says out of the side of Adam, God constructed a woman. The man is called Ish, and the woman is called Isha, Now, there is an argument in the Talmud, by the way, exactly what happened. According to one view, which is the simple way you'd read the biblical verses, first there was the male, and then God made the female from the male. There is another view in the Talmud, that the original human being, Adam, was a composite, kind of like a Siamese twin, in which there was male and female joined at the hip, or just joined, and God separated them. And that is the basis of the expression, even in English, that when you get married, you find your better half. Plato actually records the same tradition. This was known in the ancient world, that essentially you are finding your soulmate. All of these expressions come from the idea that originally man, woman were one, and that's important because that suggests that a complete human being has male and female elements within them, and each of us are only half without the relationship. So there is a machlokas. Machlokas means an argument. In the Talmud, whether first there was man and then there was woman, or there was the man-woman entity, and that God split. But either way, God said, it's not good for him to be alone, or for it, him, her to be alone. Let's separate them and make them two. So the question becomes, what's so bad about being alone? Remember, Adam is in the Garden of Eden at this point. Adam can do what he wants, except for one little tree he's not supposed to eat from. Adam doesn't need someone to do his laundry, because he could walk around naked. What is so bad about being alone if you're in the Garden of Eden? And the explanation that's given is that when man is in the Garden of Eden, he has an infinite capacity to take whatever he wants from the world. But he has no one to whom to give. He has no one to whom to share. And man is godly. We are made in the image of God. Now, the image of God does not mean that God looks like us, because as you know, that's another religion. We do not believe that God has physical form. But the image of God is a spiritual construct. That God is a giver, because there's nothing you can really give back to God. God doesn't take, God gives. God exercises free will. God, we believe, is benevolent, compassionate. We are in the image of God because we also have power, autonomy, intelligence, free will, capacities for goodness. And in order to be godly, we have to be like God, to be givers. So God created relationships in order to enable us to transcend our egotism and our selfishness, to learn to go beyond ourselves. Which means man in a state of aloneness has an infinite capacity to take, but he cannot be godly unless he is enabled to give. And therefore, human relationships were created. Now, again, I haven't fully answered your question yet, but here is our point. Human relationships were created to enable me as a man and my wife as a woman, both sides of the equation, to transcend the natural egotism and selfishness that we have, to become more godly by learning to be a giver, by learning to care about the other, by learning not to focus on number one. Because that is the only way you connect to God, because when we're filled with our ego and our arrogance and our selfishness, God's presence cannot rest within us. And marriage and parenting, to even a greater degree perhaps, are opportunities to step out of ourselves and become greater than we otherwise would have been. You may recall reading, this is before you were born, but the famous inaugural address of John F. Kennedy, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." We would say a similar thing. Ask not what a relationship does for me, although I will address the issue of not being a dish rag. Ask what you can do for your relationship. You know, they tell the story about a yeshiva boy who was ravenously eating fish for lunch. And the rabbi said to him, "Why are you eating that fish?" And the boy said, "I'm eating the fish because I love fish." He says, "Well, wait a minute. You love a fish, so you're eating it, chewing it, and spitting out the bones? If you love the fish, you would keep it alive and put it in an aquarium or throw it back into the ocean. You don't love fish. Lou, you love yourself, and you're using the fish to gratify your self-love." And the rabbi's point is a profound point, because sometimes when we say, "I love somebody," we actually mean, "I love them like I love the fish. I want to use them as a tool for my self-gratification. And when they no longer serve my needs, I throw them away, I discard them, I chew up the bones. Love is about giving, although there'll be a subtlety here. Love is about caring. Love is about transcending our egotism. Love is about not always looking after number one. And if you think about this, if you have a relationship in which each person is committed to looking after the other person and doing the best they can to give the other person a sense of well-being, then even from a selfish perspective, you're going to be much better off. Because you might be saying, I'm giving up this, I'm giving up this. Yeah, but the other person is thinking about what's good for you as well. You see, this is the meaning of the Gemara. There's a very fascinating thing. I know those who don't know Hebrew might have difficulty following this. I'm sorry, I don't have a whiteboard or a blackboard. But the word for man is Ish. Aleph Yud-Shin. The word for woman is Isha. Aleph Shin He. You notice both words share two common letters. Aleph Shin. The man has a Yud and the woman has a He. Yud and He is one of the names of God. So the Talmud says when they put God in their relationship, men are men and women are women and everything is great. If you take God out of the relationship, take out the Yud, take out the He, you get Aleph Shin. Aleph Shin is Eish. Eish means fire. Without God, you only care about yourself. You become a selfish fire, and then each one destroys the other person and destroys themselves. You know, although you know, everyone knows the Dead Sea. I don't know if you're going to go to the Dead Sea. At the Dead Sea, you could actually walk on water. You can be Jesus and the like. In Hebrew, it's not called the Dead Sea, though. This is going to be a Torah thought based on an English name, which is a little unusual. The Hebrew name for the Dead Sea, as you know, is Yam HaMelech. HaMelech, which is salt sea because of the mineral content. But in English, it is called the Dead Sea. And the reason it's called the Dead Sea is because of the mineral content. There is very little, if any, life that can live in that water. There are a few things that can, but there are certainly no fish in the Dead Sea. So I once heard a thought, which is very interesting, that one reason why it's called the Dead Sea is water flows into it, but no water flows out of it. A person is dead when they take from the world and they don't give. The meaning of being alive is giving to others. Now, this does raise two points. Again, this is a very long answer to your question, but I'm going to get back to it. Point number one is, well, you're telling me my job is to give. Well, what if I have somebody on the other side who takes? Am I supposed to be a dish rag? Am I supposed to be stepped upon? My feelings don't count? My needs don't matter? Am I supposed to totally, like, take upon myself a life, like maybe to marry the most difficult person I can find so I could be superior as a giver? Surely not. You know, Judaism is realistic. Certainly, you look for a person who is also a giver, right? You know, in other words, you want to create a relationship of reciprocity, a relationship of sharing, a relationship of growing. All of that is very true. And that's why the Torah, unlike the Catholic Church, we have divorce in the Torah. The Torah permits divorce. It doesn't like it. It's considered to be very, very sad. It says God himself weeps when a marriage has to be terminated, especially when there are children, but even before there are children. But the bottom line is, it's in there, because sometimes it's necessary. And the hope would be that even from a bad relationship, you walk away with something. And that's very important. That even from a bad relationship, you understand what it is that you need in your life. You understand how you need to improve. You understand what to look for the next time. I mean, one can get a lot of wisdom. In fact, you can get a tremendous amount of wisdom from the failures of life as well. In fact, it's been well said, we sometimes learn more from our failures than we learn from our successes. So nobody is saying that, you know, enter a relationship with no concern for whether your needs are being met. That's very, very legitimate. But at the same time, you have to learn to go beyond. You have to learn to care about others. You have to learn to connect to others. You have to learn the ability of loving. Our sages talk about, you know, people say, oh, Judaism is misogynistic. It treats women with disrespect. Well, let me just share with you what the Talmud says about the relationship of a husband and wife. You must love your wife the same way you love yourself. You must honor her more than you honor yourself. Honor, respect, cherish. That's it. The fact that men and women don't have the same responsibilities, that, you know, a man, you know, can be chazan, can be candor, a woman cannot be. Okay, listen, women can have kids, men cannot. Meaning, without getting into this, maybe we'll talk for another time, because I'm talking about relationships more than, you know, feminist issues. But the fact is, equality of dignity does not mean sameness of function. Men and women are equally beloved by God. They are equally cherished. They are equally important. God recognizes men and women have different talents, different abilities. So as a result, there may be a stratification of duties on some level. But that does not go to inferiority, superiority. That is not the way one is supposed to think. Now, do some Jews derive the wrong lessons? Yes, some Jews do. I mean, you're going to meet Jews that may denigrate women or whatever it is, but that's not authentic. That's not the way it is. Separate, you know, the Supreme Court rejected integration of schools in 1954, separate but equal. But we do believe there's a certain concept of separate but equal, and even feminists have come to recognize this. You know, people say we're now in the post-feminist age. You may have heard the expression, or the second generation feminist. It is actually said that the first generation feminists wanted to destroy and obliterate the distinction between men and women. But now the understanding is men and women do have unique and distinct abilities, and one, instead of trying to obliterate difference, one can celebrate diversity and difference. And that is a cause of celebration, as opposed to a woman trying to be like a man. Technically, for a woman to try to be like a man is the ultimate insult to a woman, because it's basically saying your value depends on your being like me, as opposed to celebrating in their own differences. So point number one about being a giver is, this does not mean indifference to your needs. And in fact, I will tell you that if you become a giver in life, you will have more of your needs met as well, because the other person is going to reciprocate. But there's another point that's even more subtle. And the other point is, this reminds me of a passage, perhaps you read this in middle school, the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. You know, Ben Franklin, one of the great founding fathers of the United States. So he came as a young man from an impoverished background. He first came to Boston. He eventually moved to Philadelphia. And he was trying to make his way in the world. And he was very shrewd, very smart, very shrewd guy. So he figured like this. He says, how do I get to know important people? He wanted to make connections, networking. So he said, well, if I ask important people for favors, they're going to resent me because I'm imposing on them. But if I do favors for them, I volunteer to do things for them, they're going to resent it because people don't like to be beholden. I don't like people to do things for me because then I feel I'm in their debt. So Franklin said, the best thing for me to do is to ask them for small, easy favors, which are not an inconvenience for them, but it gives them a sense of doing something good, and that builds up their affection. Now, Franklin was doing this for opportunistic reasons, to be sure. But in that passage, there's a great insight. And that is, sometimes the way you give to another person is by letting them give to you. And this is a lesson that men sometimes have to learn. You know, we men like to be the strong people, the strong, silent people. We like to be the ones who take care of our families. And for a man to express and expose their vulnerability, their weakness, their dependency, is something that's very, very difficult for us. That's why they have men's groups now where you sit around with a drum and you cry, you know, but make a joke about it. But it is addressing a real need that exists in society. So here is the thing. When I say be a giver, I'm not just referring to I enter a relationship and I'm the one who gives. Because how does that make the other person feel? To always be on the receiving end. To not be appreciated for what they can give you. So there's a subtlety here that sometimes the way you truly give to another person is to give them the gift of self-esteem. To show that you need them. To show that you're vulnerable. To show that they bring something to your life. So in the dynamic of being a giver, you must learn to be a taker. You become a taker because a taker is how you can give the other person a tremendous pleasure in being significant in your life. Because nobody likes to be a charity recipient. And therefore, it's been well said that side by side with telling somebody, expressing that you love somebody, is something that might even be a little harder, that you need somebody. I need you. That without you, I couldn't do the things that I need to do in my life. And that makes a person feel very, very important because they are important in your life. And therefore, when I say giving, I'm not suggesting you're the guy that's always giving, and I never need to take anything from you. You make a meal, I don't need it, I can, you know, do it myself. I don't need anything you give me, just take what I'm giving you. Well, that's not giving. That's also a form of selfishness, and that's an expression of egotism, in which I'm the guy that's giving all the time. You know, it's interesting, there's a cliche, but most cliches are true. That's why they're cliches. So I'm really not reluctant to quote cliches, because they're almost always largely true. Not completely true. That is, one of the fundamental differences between men and women is that men hate to ask directions. And women ask directions. That is why the GPS was invented by male engineers, because that guarantees I no longer have to ask any directions. But even then, I'm getting my directions from Julie, whoever that voice is. Now, the thing is this. This sounds like a trivial observation, but it is largely true, because I know when I would go on a trip with my wife, when we lived in the States, we were going to New York, let's say from Baltimore. So she would say at the beginning of the trip, maybe we should ask directions. And I would say, no, this is before GPSs. I would have to be lost at least 3 hours till I would finally break down. At some point, you know, you do break down, but it would have to be a real last resort. Now, this sounds trivial, but there's actually a very deep Kabbalistic reason for that. According to the Zohar, this is going with the view that first there was man and then there was woman, as opposed to men and women at the same time. Man's initial moments in the universe were aloneness. In other words, you know, there is a concept that your essential identity is defined by how you came into the world. Just like they say, if the first thing a duck sees is a human being, it'll be imprinted. It'll follow that human being like the mother. Actually, you know, it says that they didn't enable the duck to see the mother, the duck will follow you if it'll think you're the mother or whatever it is. So in a spiritual sense, in a global spiritual sense, the male identity is based on Adam's first moments in the universe. Adam was born into a world of aloneness. And as a result, the core of male identity is linked to autonomy, control, individuality, independence. Eve came later. A woman was born into the world of relationships. There never was an Eve without an Adam, but there was an Adam without an Eve. And as a result, for a woman, and again, I realize I'm stereotyping here, and I don't mean to say all men, all women, but I think we can speak of feminine attributes versus masculine attributes, recognizing that men have some feminine attributes and women have some masculine attributes. But as an attribute, a woman was born into the world of relationships, the world of connection, the world of looking with others and working with others. And as a result, for a woman to ask directions is not a threat to her essential identity. For me to ask directions is making a statement. I'm weak, I'm incompetent, I can't do it myself, I gotta ask other people. That's an assault on my essential identity. For a woman, that is a natural form of collaboration. In fact, I tell you, I was a law professor for many, many years. I was a law professor for more than 30 years. Almost 30 years. And when I started teaching, women were probably 10% of the law school classes. By the time I left, they're 51%. 51%, more than half of the law students and apparently the future lawyers are going to be women. And many, many commentators have noticed that in subtle ways they have changed, in part, the nature of the legal profession. In what way? It's actually very, very interesting. The standard model of the legal profession has been dragon slaying, combat, litigation, going to court. Going to court is essentially a war in which you try to obliterate the other side. My job is to kill the other side. In the Middle Ages, it literally was trial by ordeal, which, you know, or a duel. Okay, so we've gotten a little more civilized, not too much, in which we don't kill the other side by killing the other side, but we try to, you know, destroy them. And if you ever work in a law firm, I'm not advocating that you do, you know, law firms have departments. You know, you have the trust and estates people that are, you know, nice and genteel. And then you have the litigators. They're almost kept in a cage. They're like, you know, leopards and tigers, like running around screaming, you know, and this and that. And they're, you know, they are soldiers. They're battle. They're out for the kill, the jugular. So now there are some women like that as well. I'm not going to deny it. But in recent years, over the past 25, 30 years, much has shifted away from litigation towards things like mediation, compromise, working things out, win-win solutions. Now, it may be speculative, but some have suggested that the movement from litigation towards mediation correlates with the increase of women in the legal profession. Because the idea is that with men, the issue is every male out there is my enemy. And my job is to kind of destroy them so I can achieve victory, as opposed to women who believe in collaboration. So it is an interesting speculation. I don't know if it's been proven. But you can certainly correlate it on a graph that the popularity of mediation has risen as together with the years that women have become more dominant in the legal profession. Now, I'm not saying every mediator is a woman. There are many, many mediators that are men. But the overall culture, the cultural shift in the legal profession is connected to that. Now, what that means, therefore, is that this idea of community, of reaching out, of expressing your vulnerability, comes more natural to a woman than it does to a man. Again, I don't mean it'll be this way 100% of the time. But, therefore, I'm speaking to men here, that the male must learn to not only be a giver in the sense that I'm the one that's giving, but to be a giver in the sense of learning to take, learning to be vulnerable. Because what you're doing when you're doing that is you're giving the other person the greatest gift of all, the gift of being worthwhile, the gift of being needed, the gift of self-esteem. And this is something that might become hard for us to learn. But that's something. And this is such an important idea generally, that when we transcend our egotism and our arrogance, we don't become a dishrev. We actually become happier people. We become more empowered people. Because we care less about who gets the credit. We care less about the glory of things. We care less about victory. And we focus more on the moment and the joy of the moment, the joy of a relationship, the joy of children, you know, later when that comes, and the like. And one gets less obsessed with the rat race and all of the things that can destroy a person internally. Yeah.
So on the topic of the difference in delegation of masculine and feminine duties not equating to inferiority,
yes,
and superiority,
yes,
you said that a woman trying to for lack of a better way of putting it, do a man's job,
yeah,
is not, that is an insult to her, right? Because it implies that her value is contingent on my job.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you agree that, I mean, what if a woman, like, genuinely wants to do, without getting into what those attributes are, but genuinely wants to do what a man does, isn't it then giving to allow her to do that?
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. For example, I mean, I'm not against, the Torah's not against women being lawyers, doctors, university professors, university presidents.
So what's the guess?
There are halachic limitations in the types of religious roles a woman can have. So, for example, a woman cannot lead a synagogue service. A woman, although this is a bit of a controversy right now, a woman cannot officially be a rabbi, although women are great teachers of Jewish subjects as well, not just secular subjects. So I would have, in a synagogue, you'll notice men and women are separated. Now, that shouldn't be women are inferior. If anything, men are inferior, because once again, we consider the presence of women to be sexually distracting for a man, and therefore we create certain barriers of separation. But the situation is not inferior, but it's simply a certain amount of segregation. So we do have what you might call, in the synagogue area in particular, certain differentiations of roles. But they're not that many. You know, people sometimes take the few things and make a whole big deal about it. And there we do have the differences. On the other hand, in the home, women have certain roles. For example, a woman lights the Shabbat candles. And that is her special mitzvah to bring in the Shabbat that a man does not do unless he's not married or whatever. And of course, women have children. Biologically, women have certain abilities that men do not have. Tefillin is another example. You know, the talit and the tefillin, right? The prayer shawl and the tefillin. Women don't wear those. So there are some differences there. But I would say overall, we understand that although gender is a very important characteristic of a person, although with Bruce Jenner or Caitlyn Jenner, some of those boundaries are being obliterated, indeed. In fact, it's very interesting. You know, we live in such a fluid world where even the things that used to be fixed are not fixed anymore. So now sex is not, you know, gender is not fixed because you can go back and forth. Now even race is not fixed. You know, you read that story about that NAACP woman who just says she feels black, so she's black, you know, even though she has two white parents. And I saw a picture when she was 16 years old, blonde, you know, blonde or blue-eyed, etc. So I have to say, I just read in the paper, not that I endorse Rush Limbaugh at all, but he just said Rush Limbaugh is a heavy set guy, just announced. I just want to announce I am a thin person. Now, if you think I'm not thin, that doesn't matter because I think I'm thin and I identify as thin. Therefore, you know, I am thin, just like it does that parenting. So the truth of the matter is all of the boundaries of personal identity have now become, you know, almost illusions. But gender is a very important component of identity, but it's not the exclusive one. Judaism recognizes people have talents, people have individuality, people have different strengths, and the Torah does not want to limit people in the ability to express those strengths. So if a man is a poet, you know, he should write poetry. If a woman is a lawyer, a legal mind, she should pursue that. So we're not using gender to totally foreclose opportunities, but we do recognize, on the other hand, that there, at least within the religious sphere, there are certain roles, and those roles should be respected. And ultimately, a person has greater self-respect by living within their identity as opposed to trying to become somebody else. Trying to become somebody else is a profound disrespect for who you are. What do they say? A tomato is supposed to be the best tomato in the world, not try to be an orange, because the tomato is not an orange. I'm sorry, someone had a hand up, I think? Okay. All right. So that's kind of, yeah, sorry.
I just have a question going back a little bit.
Yeah.
Talking about sexual relations.
Yeah.
So one thing I've experienced with a lot of people is, you know, the feeling of, you know, sexual relations being wrong because they're not, brought up with them. You know, when you get to thinking about, you know, when I have my own kids, How do you go about you know, them being raised, although considering that they won't necessarily be raised in a life where they're not, you know, that they're abstaining, they might, you know, they might be having sex, they might not. Obviously, you know, that's very taboo, and when they're younger, you don't want to bring that up. But how do you go about having them see sexual relations in a positive light, whenever they choose to incorporate that?
To me, and obviously, you're not going to bring in the kids when you're having sex. But the important lesson is that when parents see the love and respect that exists between husbands and wife, that will give them a positive attitude towards what is a man-woman relationship. How does a man treat a woman? How does a woman treat a man? And even if they're not in the bedroom proper, but if they see love, and not just love, but also respect, friendship, which is also important. Love is this passionate thing, but we have to understand that you also need a friendship in which we trust each other and rely on each other. So that really creates a great, great foundation. Now, I'm not going to say all the kids of wonderful marriages are going to have wonderful marriages, and indeed, the other way is also true. There are children who come from broken homes who, thank God, were able to transcend the trauma of their childhood and have wonderful relationships. Human beings are resilient. Even if our backgrounds were really, really bad, we can make something good out of our lives. And I don't want to be fatalistic in that way at all. But certainly the best chance of having kids that grow up to have positive attitudes towards man-woman relationships is by modeling that relationship. It's true in all aspects of life. We don't teach our kids by lectures. We don't teach our kids by talks. We teach it by the day-to-day behaviors that we model in our lives.
Well, I think that's a very valid point, but regardless, just being growing up specifically, you know, I mean, it's very important that, you know, you see the positive things, that you're able to have a positive relationship. But even more specifically, growing up, you know, being told that, you know, to abstain from sexual relations, you know, having that put as like something that can't be done for so long, after that much time, eventually,
You're asking a very good question. And the truth of the matter is, I'll admit, I've been religious for many, many years. And this was something that still perturbed me, because I was walking, but I tell you what came to me, like Newton getting hit by the apple. So I got hit by an apple just like a year ago. And I was, you know, we live in a, what you call an ultra-Orthodox, not just Orthodox, but ultra-Orthodox, in which the separations are even bigger. And I was thinking to myself, gee, how do these kids learn to connect to a woman? Because, you know, the first woman they're going to meet is, you know, a week before they get married or something. And they really have no opportunity. But then I noticed a little Hasidic kid who was walking with his sister, and it seemed like a very, very friendly and warm conversation. And then I realized that in many, many ways, the families here are big. There's actually quite a lot of man-woman or boy-girl interaction in a non-sexual way that builds up the ability to understand the other side. Meaning, it's very, very fascinating that when God takes something away, it kind of builds in a compensatory mechanism. And the truth of the matter is, by the time a Hasidic kid is going to get married, he has spent years and years with many women in his life. And I think in some indirect way, that builds a foundation. But the other thing is, to give you a more direct answer, you're right, there's going to be a problem if the way you communicate the sexual restrictions is in the negative. Can't do this, can't do this, can't do this. But I would prefer to do it in a positive, that this is something holy, this is something special, this is something elevated, and therefore we save it for the holy time of a relationship of marriage. So then it's something that one can look forward to, and it's something that one will understand is special and holy, just like you might tell a person in a lesser way, when you're 16 you'll have a car. I'm not comparing the thing. Right, so it all depends on the attitude. You're right. If the kid is hearing for 18 years, dirty, 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 and then at 19, okay, get married and do it, that's going to create cognitive dissonance. He's not going to be able to integrate that very well. But if the message is, this is very, very special, and we wait for the right time, and the right place, and the right person, then it has a different type of resonance, you know. So it all depends. You're right. You're correct. Do we sometimes communicate the message in a wrong way? Yeah, we do. We sometimes do. But there is a right way to communicate it, and I think that would make the difference. Alrighty. So I wish you all have a real good day. I think we'll see you tomorrow.